This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Raghu Rajan. He is the former chief economist at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, former governor of the Reserve Bank of India, vice chairman of the Bank for International Settlements, featured prominently in an Oscar-winning documentary, Inside Job. Maybe a lot of you saw that. I sure did. And named Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He's a New York Times bestselling author of Fault Lines, How Hidden Fractures Still Threaten the World Economy. And his newest book, The Third Pillar, How Markets and the State Leave the Community Behind. Raghu, welcome. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you coming to us today from chilly Chicago. Is that correct?
That's right. It's cold outside.
Fantastic. Well, a lot of people would probably love to ask this maybe seemingly silly question. I'm going to ask it on their behalf and on my own. What exactly does the IMF do?
Well, it's the lender of last resort for countries. So when a country finds that it's in trouble, the financial markets aren't buying any of its sovereign debt, and it really needs money to fund imports so that people can eat and live reasonably, they go to the IMF. The country goes to the IMF and says, look, the markets have closed down to us. We have problems. We understand we need to fix them. We need to bring in our fiscal deficits. We need to spend less, tax more, but we need breathing space. Can you lend us some money for that period? And the IMF then comes in, takes a look and says, okay, if you do thus and such actions, we will lend you the money. And typically this gives countries some breathing time so that their populations don't suffer terribly during that period.
Okay, so what is the difference between the IMF and the World Bank then?
The IMF is supposed to lend to countries for short-term, what is called balance of payments problems. That is when you run a large trade deficit which you need to finance. The World Bank is more for large projects. So if you want a hydroelectric dam in the past, they don't finance that anymore. But when you did that, the World Bank used to provide the money and the dam would be built in sub-Saharan Africa, for example.
Okay. So the IMF would be more like a bridge lender, just sort of a central bank, but for the world, right? Our Federal Reserve is our lender of last resort in the U.S. And so they would be a bridge lender making short-term bridge loans, whereas the World Bank would be a mortgage lender making long, probably many decade loans, I'm guessing.
Exactly. You've got it right on.
Okay, good. Good stuff. Tell us about the third pillar. You talk a lot about communities. And when you talk about these in the book, you're referring to physical or geographical communities.
Yes. I'm talking about the local community where people know each other and people look out for each other. And what I argue in this book is really the community plays a very important role in modern economies, both in preparing people for, the market. That is, when children are very young, they learn their values from the community. Often the community looks after the school and makes sure that it works for the community children. And as the kids go through school, eventually they may go to the community college or out, but they've been well prepared for that. So the community plays a role in preparing people. And also if they fall off, so once your unemployment insurance runs out, once you get old, a lot of people return to the community for support, and the community often is critical there. Now, of course, this is what I call the third pillar. It also plays a very important role in our democracies in organizing political action. And I think this is critical to making our economies work. The other two elements are, of course, the competitive markets and the government. And my point in the book is the community holds the other two in balance. Make sure that the markets don't get too extreme, and also make sure there is a separation between the markets and the government. Many countries have succumbed to crony capitalism where the markets and government are essentially one. And the fact that we in the West largely haven't is primarily, in my view, because the community broadcasts the wishes of the people more broadly through democracy and works to creating their bands. The problem today, and that's what a lot of the book is about, is many communities are in decline. Mm-hmm. And the book talks about why this is a problem. So the communities outside our coastal cities, outside of the New Yorks and the Washingtons and the San Franciscos, aren't doing as well as they used to in the past. Mm-hmm. So the book talks about why that's a problem and also potentially how we should think about fixing it.
Mm-hmm. So the first two pillars are governments. And when you say the market being the second pillar, you don't mean the stock market. You mean the marketplace, the free market, right? In general?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. All the aspects that make up that market, including our large firms who compete with each other, the labor market where people compete for jobs, as also the financial and stock markets.
Mm-hmm. And then the community is the third pillar, if you will, right?
Right. Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. And when you talk about this, are you referring mostly to the United States or to really every country?
I set the book largely in our Western democracies, that is Europe, the United States, and to some extent Japan. But the problems are common across these countries. And often we look internally and say, this is a problem we have. And I argue the common force creating these problems across countries is primarily technological change. We've had massive technological change over the last 25 years. It's brought some amount of good. It's increased our growth rates. But typically, the disruption it's caused has come before those growth rates have come. And therefore, a lot of areas have been hit by automation, by the disruption caused by trade, which is also an offshoot of technological change, but haven't yet got the benefits, which undoubtedly will come, but will take time coming. And that's why we have more anger today about why the world is not doing as well as people thought, why their children are unlikely to have as good an experience in the world as they had.
You know, in the beginning of our talk today, you sort of were painting this, what I thought was an idyllic picture of community. It harkened back to reminding me of these old shows like, you know, Andy Griffith with Mayberry. And, mm-hmm. You know, I don't even know if you know the right reference I'm making there. But, you know, right. I don't know. I dream about that time. It's really before my era, but it sure looked right. Nice. But boy, I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I don't live there now. I live in Florida. But if I went back to LA, I don't think anyone would care about me.
No,
the hard,
absolutely.
Cold streets of Los Angeles.
Right. And I argue this is one of the effects of broadening markets and also broadening state. You know, once upon a time, it used to be that old people used to be looked after by the community because mm-hmm. they had nowhere else to go. Yeah. Today, they have Social Security. Are we better off? Yes, to some extent, because they have a reliable sort of form of income. But we are also hurt to some extent because now the community no longer has any responsibility to look after older people, and vice versa. Older people increasingly are not supportive of some of the community institutions like schools. There's sort of evidence on this. So I think you correctly point out that with modernization, the community has become weakened. At the same time, because of the need for community, you see different ways people strive to re-engage with each other, right? When I grew up in India, we used to live in apartment buildings where, you know, kids used to run in between houses. Nobody knew where one's kid was. At dinner time, a bunch of kids would show up for dinner. You wouldn't right. know whose kid was where. Uh-huh. But we don't do that anymore, certainly not in the West. But what we try and do is engage through the schools. So today, many parents have much of their social life driven by engagement with parents of their kids' friends. Mm-hmm. And that's how they come and make contact. And so I think we're constantly trying to make contact. And in the world of the future, where I think, robots and artificial intelligence programs take over much of the work, I think what is left will be the work that relates to human interaction. And one of the biggest problems we will have to deal with as we age is the problem of loneliness. Mm-hmm. And so my sense is we'll rediscover community.
You know, in England, they actually appointed a I guess, the equivalent of a cabinet post or a new department of the government to deal with loneliness. That is a serious issue. You know, it's very sort of hard to get a handle on what technology has done to us. In some ways, it has made us more connected, but in other ways, it has made us more distant and more reclusive. I remember in the 90s reading Faith Popcorn's work. Now, I don't know if you know who that is. She was a futurist, and she talked about the concept as it related just simply to home theater systems, you know, big screen TVs and surround sound, because that was a new thing back then. And she said, you know, people don't need to go to the movies anymore. And so there will be, we're starting to see this cocooning effect. And of course, that was before the internet had any real impact. And now more than ever, we see this kind of cocooning where people aren't going out. And I notice, I've been to 81 countries. And I tell you something, I notice the poorer the country, the more people are out on the street. They're in the public square, they're in these sort of public places and seemingly socializing. And my theory has always been about that. It's because, well, their houses are tiny and they're not very nice and they don't have high-speed internet access. And so they go to internet cafes or cafes in general just to use the internet.
Absolutely.
You know, and they crowd around a water fountain or in a park. In the U.S., we don't do that stuff, you know?
Yeah, we don't. And that goes to the point that there is a force in technology that keeps us self-sufficient and therefore apart. There's a force in expanding government. And we always think of governments as being opposed to markets, but they actually thrive together. The more developed the country, the larger the government, and to some extent, larger the markets. However, I think on this issue of technology and what it does to relationships, it can also add, as you pointed out earlier, and to some extent, you know, one of the experiments in the book is about this development in Toronto, where, you know, half the development was linked on the internet, and the developer ran out of money and couldn't link the other half. And a sociologist said, well, let me study the two halves and see who is more social at the end. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, the guys who had the internet were actually more social. They used to come together for block parties. They used to organize search parties to look for a missing dog. I mean, it was far more sociable. And the sociologist concluded that, you know, having human relations augmented by the ability to communicate actually makes it even better, because now you could traverse closed doors. You didn't have to knock on a door to get to the person on the other side. You could send them an email and that would traverse the door, but that wasn't possible in the one that wasn't connected. And you can see that. I mean, I see it with my kids. They certainly are much more sociable with their friends from college through Facebook and other social media. They keep in contact. While, you know, we had to call our friends one at a time by phone in order to keep in contact. So some things change for the better, and of course some things change for the worse.
But text-based communication is not communication. I mean, you must admit, that is, it's just, we need to put a moratorium on text-based communication.
Well, that may well be true, but to the extent that it augments face-to-face communication,
right, then
we can get sudden,
right,
okay, why don't we meet at thus and such place in 20 minutes?
Yes, absolutely.
I think it could help.
Absolutely. And John Nesbitt used to talk about that. He's the author of Megatrends. You know, he used to talk about the concept of high-tech, high-touch. And he said things like, the jet airplane has only led to more meetings, right? But you know, that's not necessarily true with social media, and I don't know. You know, I guess it's too early to tell, right? It's just too early to tell.
Right.
We don't know.
We're in the midst of churn, but I do believe that when all is said and done, we will rediscover that the most valuable part of us is really the human and the human relationships we have. That's what gives us identity. And when we're surrounded by the virtual world, it is a world I think we will come back to. And that's why we need to think about how we keep that going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Okay, let's switch gears if we can and talk a little bit about money. Let's talk.
Sure.
I mean, you know, that is your career, right? So interest rates, the economy, where are things going? Mm-hmm. That's what everybody wants to know. Are we headed for a recession? Are we looking at inflation, deflation, stagnation? I mean, any thoughts on what's coming our way?
We're always headed towards a recession because we haven't learned how to eliminate that from public life. So
well, every 10 years, so I guess we are always headed for one. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Right. So the question is how far down the line and what might cause it. I think to some extent, towards the end of last year, a whole set of pieces of bad information were coming together, slowdown in Europe, slowdown in China, the trade war, and of course the Fed was raising interest rates at regular intervals and saying we're still not done and they were off from it.
Too aggressively, I think. Yeah.
Well, so what the Fed did in January was backed off from that path and made it much more clear that what it meant or intended to mean was that it would look at the data and then act accordingly. And I think the timing of that statement has essentially been taken by the market as a signal that the Fed now does pay attention to what's happening in the market. And if the market falls, the Fed will come in and support it, the so-called Fed put. And as a result, I think the markets are celebrating quite significantly, and many assets that were thought of as too risky towards the end of last year are back in favor. Mm-hmm. I think broadly, the Fed has bought us some time before that eventual recession. I think recessions are the hardest thing for economists to predict, though everybody thinks they can. But I do believe that we've pushed it beyond the end of this year for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is, I mean, going forward, what could be the factors that trigger something like a recession? Well, for sure, if interest rates start going up once again, especially if inflation picks up, of course, there's no sign yet that it is going to pick up strongly, which is why the Fed is going to watch and wait. I think that is one factor. The other, which is, I think, a little more worrisome because it builds up continuously, is leverage.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a certain caution about leverage towards the end of the year. It was hard to get leveraged loans anymore. And that caution has disappeared once again. And my worry is the longer we have accommodative conditions, the more we build up leverage, which then means when the conditions turn, it could precipitate a worse problem.
So these are, you know, we're really sort of harkening back to what you call fault lines in your prior book. Are interest rates, and especially mortgage interest rates, home mortgages, are they artificially low still? I mean, I believe they've always been artificially low since the creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because they're effectively subsidized by the government. But, you know, assuming that these entities stay in place and we continue to have them for the next many, many years, are they artificially low or do we have a legitimate market, you know, mortgage market rate, if you will?
I think that if you had asked this question a couple of years ago, it would be very hard to tell because the central banks were in full force buying and holding on to significant amounts of long-term instruments.
Mm-hmm.
I think since the Fed started unwinding its balance sheet and selling some of the bonds that it holds, or certainly not reinvesting in them, I think there's more of a sense that in the U.S., the prices for these long bonds and therefore the long-term interest rates reflect to a greater extent a true market value. Of course, there are still central banks like the Bank of Japan, which are buying long bonds and keeping long rates low. But I think the growing consensus is that we are in a low interest rate environment and that long rates at these levels are consistent with a sense that growth over the medium term is going to be, you know, not great, not terrible, so-so. And therefore, you know, interest rates will not move up hugely from these levels.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think thus far this is predicated on inflation being really quite low, and it's been low so far despite, you know, labor markets tightening up, that is unemployment rates falling to decadal lows, both in the United States, but also in Europe and in Japan. And that's surprising for most economists. With labor markets so tight, why aren't we seeing more wage inflation? Earlier, the story was you're not seeing workers asking for higher wages because they fear that workers elsewhere will take their jobs. Mm-hmm. With many economies close to what they considered full employment, there aren't that many workers around to take their jobs. And so the great puzzle is why wages aren't moving up faster at this point, especially when every business person is complaining about not finding skilled workers. My guess is this is why the Fed is sitting in that uncomfortable place where it doesn't quite know whether inflation is just around the corner, which is why it won't say it's paused. At the same time, it doesn't see growth that is very strong, and therefore it's not willing to commit now to a path of interest rate rises. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're in a new world. Mm-hmm. We don't fully understand this world. And of course, there are lots of theories around as to what's going on. Larry Summers talks about secular stagnation. Others talk about modern monetary theory, where you print any amount of money you want and there's no problem.
So, by the way, I have to ask you, what do you think about MMT? I think it's a fantasy.
I do think that it would be wonderful if it were true. I'm very skeptical.
Yeah, me too. I couldn't agree more. You know, an interesting study by the American Enterprise Institute looked at inflation over the last 20 years, and it was mind-boggling. If you could only see this graph I'm looking out at, I went over it in detail on another episode. It just talks about consumer goods, services, and wages. And it shows that in the last 20 years, the cost of televisions, toys, computer software, cell phone service, clothing, it's all become less expensive, right? Obviously, I mean, right. You know, you don't have to be a genius right. to know this. Cars, they say, are about even, but that's not true because the automobile today is so much better than it was 20 years ago. So, right. you know, hedonically, I mean, it's deflated massively. But yet, housing, food and beverage, medical care, child care, college tuition, textbooks, which have to be the biggest scam in history, hospital services, much more expensive. And it's just sort of hard to figure out. I look at this as this epic war. You know, it's this war between the deflationary effects of technology and the inflationary effects of monetary policy. Who's going to win or lose right. that war? Will technology, because it's so deflationary and things just keep getting so much better at lower prices, or will our massive amount of debt cause inflation? I don't know. Who's going to win that war? You know?
Right now, this is a very interesting question. There's also, I mean, the way you put it, there is good deflation and bad deflation, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And good deflation is when you're making, you know, stuff better, more productively, mm-hmm. and prices are falling for that reason. And bad deflation is, you know, because people are scared, there's fear, and activity is down, that's why you get lower prices. And for a long time in the 19th century, we had good deflation because things were getting more productive. Mm-hmm. But of course, that deflation hit people who had debt, like farmers. And that's when you had the big farmer agitations and the populism in the late 19th century. So even with good deflation, it is possible sometimes that you get some unanticipated effects. The broader point, however, is that we are in a new world and we have to formulate policies for this new world and maybe not stay with policies that were targeted at the old world. That said, I think we have to be careful about accepting any new theory that comes along.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Is there anything else you want to say as we wrap it up? Maybe a question I didn't ask you about any of your books or your work or thoughts on the economy?
No, you've been very good. You've been very good. And this is perfect.
Okay. Well, Raghu, thank you for joining us. Just to remind the listeners, you've got several books, including Fault Lines and the new book, The Third Pillar, How Markets and the State Leave the Community Behind. And maybe just to go back to that subject we started with on the community issue, can't remember whose song it is, but I believe the song is called Alone. You know, it's a contemporary sort of EDM song. And the lyrics uh-huh. are, everybody's connected, but no one is connecting. And, you know, I think that's really a pretty good way to sum up our technological era in which we live. So we've got to make sure we actually connect, even though we're just
absolutely
connected, right?
I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah. That's why we need to rethink our society. And, I mean, it can't be done forcibly, but we have to recognize what we're losing and how we connect one again, not just with our friends, but across society.
Everything is a trade-off. It certainly is, and we have to be mindful of that. Raghu, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.